Pop Scene Special.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN. Coming up, the life and music of Aretha Franklin. And we'll begin in 1969, when she'd really just hit her peak.
Hi and hello, this is Richard Coombe with the Pop Scene Special on Lady Soul, Aretha Franklin. In 1967, Aretha Franklin rocketed to the top of the pop charts, won 3 gold records, one actually for that thing, Chain of Fools, and was launched as the Queen of Soul Music, a term which could almost have been coined for her. For 2 years, the Queen reigned supreme, with several more million-selling singles, and the musical public showing its appreciation when she quickly became Aretha, like Ella and Sarah, a tribute to a great singer. And here's where it all started, way back in the late 50s for Lady Soul.
Rock-a-bye, your baby with a Dixie melody.
A Pop Scene Special in 1969. Aretha Franklin's recent death and funeral have captured attention all around the world. And at the time of her death, we spoke to Nick Coleman, the author of Voices, about her importance in pop music. But there's nothing like an eyewitness, and for more than 60 years, Anthony Heilbutt was just that. His 1971 book, The Gospel Sound, is one of the definitive works on gospel music in America, and his most recent collection of writings, The Fan Who Knew Too Much, has a lovely essay about Aretha Franklin at its heart. He's been following her since the 1950s, and he's met her. And I spoke to him the other day on the phone from New York City. Anthony Heilbutt, welcome to The Music Show. I have to ask you, first of all, about your presence at Aretha Franklin's first known concert performance in New York, in Brooklyn, at the Washington Temple Church of God in Christ. Yes. She was 15 and you were 16.
Before, that's right.
What took you there in the first place?
Well, I had been following gospel music for 2 or 3 years. I started very early. I started going to the Apollo Theater in Harlem when I was 14. I didn't actually go particularly for Aretha. She was part of a package which was led by her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, who at that time was the top preacher in the black church circuit. And he had a very exciting troupe with him, including one of my favorite gospel groups, the Davis Sisters, whose lead singer, Jackie Verdell, is one of Aretha's greatest influences. And there was a little person named Miss Sammy Bryant, who was very short, but had huge volume. All three of these artists interested me a bit more than Aretha, who had just made her first recording, a song called Never Grow Old, which had become a great hit. And, of course, I was very interested in hearing her, but she was definitely the child wonder.
And what was she like that night?
In a funny way, sir, she was what she would always be. If Aretha was by herself, particularly in a church, but if she was performing by herself in almost any situation, she would sit at the piano, she would accompany herself brilliantly, she was a great pianist, and sing extremely well because she was responding to her own chords. And when she was finished with the two songs, she would get up and do a dance. In the black church, and actually in the white Pentecostal church as well, the dance is known as the shout. For example, when you would see videos of Aretha in the late 60s singing Respect, and she starts dancing, she is doing that church shout. And when she finished the second song, she hollered very loudly, "Yes, sir." And that was something that she continued to do to the very end. She would holler that at the White House when she was performing for President Obama.
So it was all there in the microcosm, at least,
yes,
that first performance.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And she was, you know, in retrospect, a brilliant artist from the start, a brilliant student because she was so involved with her and she was learning so much from the people who inspired her and who continued to inspire her. You know, the singers whose work she performed to the end of her life.
Yes, well, you talk about these influences on her in your essay in The Fan Who Knew Too Much, and that you name all sorts of names, Billie Holiday, Little Jimmy Scott, Dinah Washington, of course, the gospel singers.
My sense is, even if she learned from those her earlier names you mentioned, and Dinah Washington, who came out of gospel, who was a generation older than Aretha, but who had a very similar background, would have been maybe the closest to her. Although she did pick up from Little Jimmy Scott his way of singing way behind the beat, something she enjoyed to do. For example, people were always confounded by her performances of things like the national anthem. She would. I said one point, I think, in The Fan Who Knew Too Much, that the orchestra had reached the rocket's red glare, and she was still, "Oh, say, can you see?" The thing is, she was singing with all kinds of liberties and freedoms. Now, if you know the style, you know, this was the gospel church way of singing hymns. And probably her greatest influence was the great Baptist hymn singer Clara Ward. And Clara Ward had been trained by possibly the first woman to sing in that style, Mary Johnson Davis. And recently I learned that Aretha's mother, Barbara, who died when she was quite young and who never made any records, sang in the same style of Miss Davis. So this was a kind of long, drawn out, lots of melisma, lots of note bending, lots of what people called the runs, approach to song. And people were dumbfounded when she was singing this way. And I think she sang the national anthem last year at some football stadium, and all the football players were standing, and, you know, mystified. Where was the song going? When would she finish it? Her only accompanist was an organist who was listening very attentively because he knew what she was doing. But even he was paying extra attention.
Well, that's probably why it was best that she played piano for herself, wasn't it?
Oh, oh, say, can you see?
I read in some of the obits about Aretha's debt to jazz musicians, and she played with many jazz musicians in her early years. For example, she would do gigs with John Coltrane and geniuses of that sort. But the truth is that most of the good gospel pianists in the early 50s, and certainly by 1958, were themselves very influenced by jazz. And in fact, some of them were so great that they influenced jazz musicians themselves. In other words, if Aretha had stuck only to her gospel influences, I don't think there would have been much difference than the Aretha that we hear. And years later, when she sang something like Nessun Dorma, of course, she was trying to show that she was open to all kinds of influences. Though there are those who said even Nessun Dorma she gospelized. But what people love in Aretha, and certainly the most famous hits, all betray her gospel influences.
Well, certainly this is something that her great producer Jerry Wexler identified. But before we talk about Jerry Wexler, let's talk about her Columbia years, and particularly John Hammond, who produced the first couple of albums for her there. What did he hear, do you think, and what did he perhaps get wrong in producing her?
I must say John Hammond was great help to me. My first book, as you probably know, is called The Gospel Sound, and it was the first book on gospel. I've updated it, and it's been in print since 1971. And he allowed me to produce a couple of albums called The Gospel Sound for Columbia as part of what was called the John Hammond Collection. So I owe him a great deal. I was very lucky. I was invited to a party where a very great man, a great publicist named Al Duckett, who was also a great political figure because he ghostwrote a lot of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speeches. Anyway, he gave the party, and suddenly everyone was very quiet, and it was the first public exposure of Aretha Franklin's audition tape for Columbia. And can you imagine what it? You know, this really excited me, especially because I thought Aretha sounded better than she had had in the, than she had sounded in the church. On the strength of that audition tape, John Hammond signed Aretha and said that he thought that she was going to be the greatest female singer since Billie Holiday. He only produced her first two albums for Columbia, which I think are very great albums, and he got exceptionally good musicians for her, particularly on the first album, where she sang, among other things, the song that she had auditioned, Today I Sing the Blues. And she sang that on that album, and the album got some good attention. And I think she had a couple of decent sellers off the first couple of albums. And then she had other producers, some of who were great R&B producers. But I think the Columbia, I think there's some real masterpieces on Columbia, but they just didn't sell. You know, they didn't take over the world the way those songs like Never Loved a Man or Respect did. But the artistry is definitely there. And among other things, the voice is perfect. She was young and in total control of her chops.
Perhaps the correct question to have asked you then is, what did Jerry Wexler do right?
He said he returned her to church, but the truth is that she never left church as long as she was playing for herself. Wexler said that he never had that close a personal relation with Aretha, that she kept herself rather distant, and he described the sessions when he and the musicians were just having a ball. You know, what a thrill to be working with this genius. And Aretha would be sitting in a corner, sort of meditating to herself. And then it was ready, she was ready, and there'd be magic. But as I think I've said before, she was always happier with church musicians like the great organist. Do you remember Billy Preston?
Yes.
Because with those musicians, or the musician who was following her last year when she was making her way through the Star Spangled Banner, these are people who understood her totally. And Jerry Wexler, whom I knew and had a, you know, had a very nice relation with, Jerry told me that, for example, when he recorded Overdub with Eric Clapton, I think it's pretty famous, that at first it didn't work. And then eventually it did, at least by his standards. But Aretha was so used to these church musicians who would get her right away, who understood exactly what she was trying to do. And that may be why she was sitting by herself. And I said, you know, there's an old church idiom, looking to the hills from whence cometh my strength. And I think that's probably what she was trying to do, just trying to figure out what would happen next. By the way, in every report I've read, it would seem that she produced the sessions, that ultimately she made all the decisions, and that the people were following her. It wasn't a case of someone else cueing it.
You said that Jerry Wexler said that they were never close. You knew Aretha Franklin, and I wonder whether it was simply that she was a rather private person.
I didn't know her that well, and she was a complicated person, my sense is. If she wanted to chat, she would chat. One time she called me to talk about a couple of these great gospel men who were two of her father's favorite singers, J. Robert Bradley and Robin Anderson. And somehow she discovered that I had produced both of them. I found these old, they were old, and they, you know, the people had forgotten them, but it was a super thrill to work with them. And do you know that she talked for about 3 or 4 hours about this? And yet I'm told, I've heard many stories about her, you know, being quite curt and distant. and many tales of people coming up and showering her with compliments, and she saying, okay, okay, and walking off. So complicated.
You better think. I ain't no psychiatrist, I ain't no doctor with the greens, but it don't take too much time to see what you're doing to me. You better think about what you're trying to do to
what
me.
What do you feel about Aretha Franklin as a figure in the civil rights movement? Because there are people who associate respect with that movement, there, and certainly her song Think is often associated with that. But you write again in The Fan Who Knew Too Much, Anthony Harbutt, about her insertion of this word freedom, which is in a sense sort of not really part of the song, and how in any case when she sings it, it sounds like Jesus.
One of her sexiest blues was a song called Dr. Feelgood. And of course, anyone who knows gospel knows the original of the song was Dr. Jesus. What was so interesting about Aretha is, without making many overt political statements, she was always implying something politically. We know, of course, of her support of Angela Davis, a very famous black woman radical in the late 1960s, which was very daring even for the civil rights movement. Up to the end of her life, she was traveling. Even on her secular concerts, she would feature sermons by a man named Carlton Pearson, who had one time been the king of the gospel church, but had become very progressive. The gospel church can be very, very homophobic. And Pearson was one of the first major ministers to come out in favor of LGBT people. And Aretha selected him to be her pastor. Without saying a word, she was making her commitment clear.
She was leading by example then, really, wasn't she? I mean, she was. It was, in a sense, the quality of her work was so high that that said all that needed to be said.
Yeah, and the fact that she was so respected meant that many of the preachers who were right-wing, you know, really had to shut up. You know, they might continue to mount their programs, but they were so awestruck to be in her presence that they wouldn't dare say anything negative. They knew where her heart lay.
I said at the beginning, Anthony Heilbutt, that you were present at Aretha Franklin's first performance in New York. You were also there for one of her last performances. Could you tell us about that?
I was simply in front of my computer on YouTube. I saw what was described as her last performance at the Mann City Center in Philadelphia. And the concert ended with her performing a song called The Old Landmark, which had been popularized by the famous Ward Singers. The two lead singers of the Ward Singers were incredibly influential. Clara Ward was perhaps Aretha's biggest influence, as I said earlier, particularly on the hymns. And the other lead, Marion Williams, was the one who inspired both Little Richard and Nina Simone. So these were some formidable women. Anyway, Aretha sang the song The Old Landmark, and she talked about the Ward Singers, and she said, they were so bad, I mean good. There was a time when bad, you know, that was a popular idiom once meant to be that so bad, meaning excellent. And after she sang the song, as she did often in her last concerts, she went into kind of a testimony where she would hum and moan and groan in the style of both Clara Ward and her father, C.L. Franklin. So you see that she was really returning, as I said, to an arc of safety.
And this is in Philadelphia, which is the home of the Ward Singers, anyway.
Yes, yes, yes. You know, what could, in a way, be more perfect? It's so funny that the gospel that I love most, and that Aretha loved most, the gospel of, you know, of the 50s, ended pretty much in 1960, as you can imagine. And gospel has continued, and it's gone through many permutations and combinations. And yet to the end of her life, Aretha did not sing the new gospel, which is known as contemporary gospel. She was singing something like the old landmark, which the award singers recorded in 1951, sir. So there, here in 2018, she was singing a song that had been recorded almost 70 years earlier. That's how she ended her career.
Now let us all go back to the old. Let us all go back to the old.
That's Aretha Franklin with the Southern California Community Choir and the gospel standard she sang until the end of her life, The Old Landmark. From her 1972 live recording, that was. That's from Amazing Grace, the biggest selling album of her career. I was speaking to the gospel writer and historian and record producer Anthony Heilbutt from New York, and he writes about Aretha Franklin, as I mentioned, in his latest book, The Fan Who Knew Too Much.